talked about the needs of Black people. He always put Black people first in the way he analyzed political processes. So I'm not sure, it's funny that that's one of your questions, because I often ask, what would Glenn say about any number of things since he passed away in 2021? I'm sure he would be talking about the need for independent politics, especially for independent politics for Black people, and reminding us of the weaknesses and the failures of electoral politics in this country, which, as I have said, are to blame for our current predicament.
You know, I wonder, Margaret, where your hope lies. Are you still, nevertheless, despite the circumstances of the current government, the state of affairs in this country, are you nevertheless hopeful? And if so, what gives you that hope?
I am hopeful because it's always popular action. The union movement, the civil rights movement, the environmental movement, it's the people. But it's been a long time. So my fear is that people literally don't know what to do. So, for example, a couple of weeks ago, there was a boycott announced of major retailers. Don't go to Walmart. Don't go to Target. Boycott Amazon, all of which I'm in favor of. But that kind of thing has to be done in coordination with other actions, with political education. So people want to do something. They want to protect themselves from these forces that we've been discussing, and the people can do it. But I think there has to be a realization that we have to relearn this stuff, because it's been a very long time. But that's my optimism. People are the ones to bring about change. And we talked about Lincoln Heights, Ohio. That's one example. But also we have to talk about who crushed Occupy Wall Street, the Obama administration. But I'm optimistic as long as people understand that it's us, we are the ones who have to move, and it has to be independent of electoral politics.
Margaret, how can our listeners follow your work?
I am, as you said, editor of blackagendareport.com. We publish every Wednesday. We have Black Agenda Radio every Friday on our site. It can also be heard on WBAI in New York, WPFW in Washington. I'm on the X, I still say Twitter quite often, the X platform. My handle is Freedom Ride Blog, and Black Agenda Report can be seen on Facebook as well.
Jim Laffrey and I are very grateful for your being on Law and Disorder. Keep up your good work. It's been terrific. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
It's one thing to wring our hands in despair over the re-election of Donald Trump and decry his out-of-the-gate authoritarian neo-fascist assault on U.S. democracy and governance. It's quite another to offer and begin to employ a comprehensive strategy for not only combating the new Trump administration, but to also advance a political ideology that challenges conventional wisdom over what is needed to make our country a truly democratic country and a country that meets the needs of all of its people, not simply its billionaire class. Yet the billionaire class just keeps getting richer and more powerful. Last year, the world's five richest billionaires increased their wealth by $542 billion. Elon Musk's wealth alone is fast approaching $500 billion. And globally, we are seeing the highest levels of inequality in human history. So today, we've invited to the show a guest with a radical vision of what is needed to not only defend against Trump's dictatorial moves and legislative plans, but in a vastly more profound way to bring about the end of the unjust and exploitative capitalist system of the rich in America and replace it with an equitable and democratic system of governance. And that is precisely what our guest today is committed to doing. She is Kashama Sawant, a socialist economist who was elected to and served 10 years on the Seattle, Washington City Council. Her election and her advancement of a strong progressive agenda on the council was often national news. So, Kashama Sawant, a warm, warm welcome to Law and Disorder Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Last month, there was a Workers' Strike Back conference, and you're a founder of Workers' Strike Back. It was held in Seattle, Washington. It featured speeches by Chris Hedges, a frequent guest on this show, Dr. Jill Stein, the Green Party leader, and yourself. What was the purpose of that conference? How many people attended? And was there any final resolution of any sort passed by those attending the conference?
I'm so glad you're asking about this because, you know, really this moment in U.S. history is defined by Donald Trump and his billionaire-dominated cabinet and the Republican Party, who are determined to harm working and poor people's living standards. But on the other hand, you have the Democrats in Congress who have refused to fight back. And in fact, they say that they are pissed at the grassroots which are demanding that they fight back, because and the reason they're not fighting back is because essentially Trump is an existential threat. Even though they claim Trump is an existential threat, they also serve elite interests. And then on the other hand, you have the working people, the mass of working people in the United States, who are completely opposed in overwhelming majorities to these attacks on living standards. So what's missing here is a fight against the rich. And that was why Workers' Strike Back hosted this national Fight the Rich organizing conference that you talked about just over 2 weeks ago. And the conference was attended in person by 300 people, and over 200,000 in total watched the live stream of the conference. It focused on the urgent need to build a fighting workers' movement independent of both the Democratic and Republican parties, which are both warmongering parties of the billionaire class. And we discussed a strategy to build such a movement. And as far as the vote is concerned, on the day of the organizing conference, we had a discussion about the strategy and the program. The day after, we had the Workers' Strike Back National Convention, which was our inaugural one. And there we took votes on the Fight the Rich program, which was approved by the overwhelming majority.
You served on the city council in Seattle for 10 years. I believe the other members of the city council were all members of the Democratic Party. And you led an effort on the council to pass, and it did pass, what is the highest minimum wage for workers in the whole country. Yet you've written that the rest of the council members viciously opposed virtually every pro-worker piece of legislation I fought for. Is this evidence in support of your contention that the Democratic Party, like the Republican Party, is a capitalist party and will not ultimately do what's needed if we are to have an economically and socially just society?
It absolutely is evidence of that. And in fact, it's crucial evidence in the sense that, you know, most people are who are completely disappointed and demoralized by the fact that the Democratic Party, even despite is somewhat of its rhetoric, is not actually fighting to win victories for working people, improve living standards, help oppressed communities. And we are often told that you should not expect any change in Congress because that's very hard. Change happens at the local level. Well, we did it at the local level. And what we found was that this supposed dichotomy between local versus federal is a false one. Really, the Democratic Party is a party of the elite. And no matter at what level, if working people mount an actual fight back, which threatens the bottom line of big business and the wealthy, then the Democratic Party will absolutely doggedly represent their interests against working people's needs. And throughout the 10 years that I served in the city council, I saw the Democratic Party oppose, as I said in that quote you read out, virtually every progressive issue that we brought forward. In fact, starting with the $15 an hour minimum wage, I don't know how many of your listeners know, but our 15 Now movement, which I launched right after I took office in early 2014, won the first major city $15 an hour minimum wage. With that, we also won inflation increases. So today, the minimum wage in Seattle for all minimum wage workers is $20.76, which is by far the highest in the nation and in any major city. And so the history of how we won 15 itself is an illustration of the true nature of the Democratic Party. A few weeks after I took office, two of the most prominent Democrats, and you're right, Mike, that it is all Democrats. There were eight Democrats and I was one socialist. Two of the most prominent ones came into my city council office, sat me down and told me, it's all well and good, you have rabble-roused your way to City Hall, but we're here to tell you that City Hall runs on our terms and you're not going to pass any minimum wage increase, let alone 15. Less than 6 months from that conversation, we had won $15 an hour. The reason we won is we, meaning those of us who were in the leadership of 15 now, including myself and my council office, we were crystal clear that if we put our faith in the Democratic Party, then this is going to be a losing proposition. The only way to win is to build a fighting movement. And it was contradictory to many of the people who advised, you know, this sage advice that they gave me and other working people in 15 now, that, you know, I was often told, I agree with what you're fighting for, what you're pushing for, but can't you be nice? Like, do you have to be mean? And that misses the point entirely, in the sense that if those of us who are in the leadership of movements don't expose the true nature of the Democratic Party, then people will continue to have illusions in them. And those, that sort of that grip of illusions in the Democratic Party, I would contend, is the single most crucial obstacle to overcome if we are to build the kind of militant movements we need to improve the lives of working people, not to mention end the war on Gaza.
So then, Shamba, I gather it's your position that even though there may appear to be, or actually are, often some significant differences between the two parties on certain issues, that when push comes to shove, neither party is really more than a lesser evil of the two capitalist parties. And so that's why we need a new movement and a new party for real across-the-board political change. Have I said that correctly?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, that's why, crucially, one of the main points underlining this Fight the Rich organizing conference that we had and all the program that was voted on by Workers' Strike Back members the next day was the fact this is an obstacle, that if we put our faith in either the Democrats or the Republicans, and that's why the working class and our movements need a new party. If we want to end the genocide on Gaza, we have to organize independently and use that as a step forward towards a new party. And as far as on the idea of Democrats being different than Republicans, yeah, I mean, obviously, there are differences. But if you look at what's happened over time, what's happened is that Democrats have betrayed the working class over and over again. And that has created an opening for the right wing in the absence of any actual militant working class left alternative. And what's happened in response to that is that the Democratic Party has further moved to the right. The right wing is further moving to the right. Now you have Trump 2.0, and the Democrats are also moving to the right, alongside them. So you see that there is no way out of this logjam and this sort of vicious cycle that working people are going to get pushed into unless we organize independently. And it is important that we organize on a working class basis. You know, say that this is, make it very clear, this is a class war, not a culture war. It is a class war between the billionaires, the capitalists, and working people and the poor. And if we are to win anything for working people and the poor, then we have to unite working people and the poor against the rich.
Shama, you've got a piece in Counterpunch, the online magazine, entitled Fight the Rich. And in it, you write that, quote, questions that looms over everything else is, how can we turn broad support for fundamental change into action? What's your answer, in broad strokes, to that question? And what do you mean when you claim that there's broad support for change? I mean, can it not be argued that Trump's election was evidence of broad support for change, but in a very different sort of way?
I think it is a deep irony. It's a tragic irony that at this moment, it is someone like Trump who won the election. Because if you look at the actual sort of facts on the ground, if you look at where ordinary working people, and I mean across the board, Democrats, Republicans, people who didn't vote at all, people who voted for Jill Stein and others, across the board, if you look at political opinions, the positions of working class people overwhelmingly oppose the anti-worker agenda that Donald Trump is putting forward, and that, unfortunately, the Democrats are going to go ahead and support for the most part. Large majorities of working people oppose eliminating any help for students who are struggling with student debt. 80% oppose cuts to food stamps. A whopping 90% of Americans are against cuts to Medicare and Medicaid. We got a poll recently which showed that 62% of a majority in the U.S. believe that the government should ensure all Americans have healthcare coverage. In other words, support for something like Medicare for All. And two-thirds of the respondents in a poll showed that said that they believe the horrific pursuit of profits in the health insurance industry and the treatment of ordinary people and the lack of healthcare was partially responsible for the killing of Brian Thompson, the United Healthcare CEO last year. And we also see extensive polls showing, poll after poll, showing that a majority of Americans support taxing the rich. So in other words, it's the opposite of what Trump and now most of Congress is going to support, which is making the tax cuts that Trump 1.0 instituted and then that Biden continued making those tax cuts for the rich permanent. Well, the majority of Americans absolutely opposed that. In fact, there was a very recent aggregate of multiple polls. This study aggregated 55 national and state polls on billionaire and wealth taxes, and overwhelming majority of people, 2 out of 3, support the the idea of taxing the wealthy. And then last but not least, we can't leave this out. What is the support for the war on Gaza, the genocide in Gaza? In fact, right now, the 46% in one of the latest polls, 46% expressing support for the Israeli state. That's the lowest in 25 years of Gallup polling on this issue. And the number that are supporting the Palestinians is now the highest. It is up 6 percentage points from even last year, and it's the highest poll ever. So progressive agenda, the pro-worker, anti-war, anti-genocide agenda that the overwhelming majority of American people support runs across the spectrum. What you don't see is any representation of this in either the Democratic or Republican Party. And the example that we set in Seattle shows that independent fighting politics, it's what's needed.
Well, you know, and following up on that, that same Counterpunch article also addressed the issue of how, if we're going to be successful, that is, in bringing about a more equitable and just society, how we've got to fight for it in new and more effective ways. And you cite as an example the issue of, which you mentioned in passing in your last answer, you mentioned the issue of Medicare for All. It's a very popular concept. And you point out that many leading Democrats even have indicated support for it, yet it has not come about. So please talk to us about why it did not come to pass, has not yet come about.
I think this the issue of Medicare for All, and as you said in your question, the understanding why it's not come about is actually a very useful illustration of why having any kind of a faith in the Democratic Party is actually the death knell of winning anything substantial for working people. If you look at what happened with the Squad and also Bernie Sanders and so on in Congress, I don't know how many of your listeners will remember, but some years ago there was, you know, there were 6 Squad members in Congress and in the House, and Nancy Pelosi, the arch pro-capitalist Democratic leader, was up for re-election among the Democrats as the leader of the Democrats and House Speaker. And there was a major grassroots push from working people. I was part of that. Many other activists were part of that, which was called Force the Vote, where we said that actually now you have a numerical leverage with your vote, so you should withhold your vote for Nancy Pelosi. You should demand Congress pass Medicare for All. And in aid of that push, you should organize. You should use your congressional offices, which is a phenomenal platform you have, to use that to build mass rallies throughout the nation in support of Medicare for All. This would also push the, and I wrote about this, this would push the labor leadership, which is also unfortunately tied to the Democratic Party. It would push them into action. Let's bring to bear the power of millions of working people, including within that millions of union members, shutting down the economy, saying we want Medicare for All and we're not going to allow the status quo to continue. What happened? At that time, AOC and the Squad completely refused to support any such measure. Then you had Biden getting elected. And at that time, for two years, not only did you have a Democrat in the White House, you had the Democratic Party with majorities in both houses of Congress. What happened at that time? Bernie Sanders refused to fight for anything. So the point is that Bernie Sanders, does he in his heart support Medicare for All? I think he does, but that's not the issue. The issue is that he has completely betrayed working people because he was never, ever willing to actually pose a challenge to the Democratic Party. And he went so far that he ended up uncritically cheerleading Biden. And then when Biden stepped down and we had Harris as the candidate, Bernie Sanders shilled for her as well. And then if you look at what happened in California, over two years, I believe in 2017 and 2022, the California Nurses Union and many other organizations, genuine organizations, were supporting Medicare for All. They really built a campaign around it, but the fatal flaw in their strategy was they put their faith in the Democratic Party. And what happened? Again, it's a state that has a Democratic governor, massive majorities for the Democratic Party in Congress, in the state legislature. I mean, like something like 80%. And what happened? The Democrats put the kibosh on Medicare for All both times. So the history of trying to win Medicare for All through the Democratic Party is littered with examples of complete failure. And that's why we need an independent strategy, which means we have to build an independent movement to win Medicare for All. But the movement's leadership has to have clarity that expect to have the whole might of the US state, the Democratic and Republican parties, big business, big pharma, big insurance against you. And the only way to win is to build working class power and leverage the power that working people have, which is of withholding our labor. So I don't believe that Medicare for All can be won without a real serious strategy of mass protests, mass civil disobedience, mass workplace shutdowns. And that needs to start somewhere in Seattle. We are in through worker strike back. We have begun discussing the possibility of doing a ballot initiative in relation to healthcare. And I just want to be clear, if we do launch this campaign, again, we should expect the full might of big business and the Democratic Party against us. So we will need to build a mass movement here as well.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my former law partner, Attorney Jim Lafferty, and we're discussing with Shyama Sawant, the leader of Workers Fight Back. We're discussing where to go from here. Shyama, let's talk about what strategies would work. For example, you write about the strategy you used to get the Democratic Party, all the members in the city council, to pass the country's highest minimum wage ordinance. Talk about how you did that.
Yes. So, the bedrock of this strategy is there are many lessons that we can learn from the way we were able to win not only the $15 an hour minimum wage, but also the Amazon tax, which taxes big businesses like Amazon to fund affordable housing. Last year alone, this tax raised over $400 million. It was hugely successful. We have won unprecedented renters' rights victories for working class people. And the way we did that, and as I said, the bedrock of all of this was knowing your enemy, knowing that the Democratic Party, the bosses, the corporate landlords, Amazon Corporation, Jeff Bezos, billionaires, they're not going to be on your side. And understanding that the reason they will fight tooth and nail against you, even for what seem like moderate improvements in our living standards, is because one, capitalism is a zero-sum game. So the only meaningful improvements in our living standards can come if we demand us a share of the profits that they have stolen, bosses have stolen through our labor. They don't want any hit on their bottom line. I mean, they, even though they have trillions of dollars, they are not going to let that go. And most importantly for them, they don't want an example to be set of a successful working class fight back, because that example is the most dangerous as far as they are concerned, because that example leads to other victories, because people feel emboldened. It's a contagion of emboldening that the ruling class does not want to see. And so that clarity enabled us to understand how to traverse the treacherous terrain of City Hall, of politics under capitalism. And that meant rule number one was, I don't go there as a city council member thinking these Democrats are my colleagues. I go there to use my office to conduct class war on behalf of the working class against the ruling class. You are not there to be nice to the Democratic Party Council members because they represent a very not nice reality under capitalism where, for example, in Seattle, we had 100,000 workers living in poverty because of the low minimum wages. So that clarity that I'm there to fight for working people was crucial. Just to give you two concrete examples of what that meant, one thing is when we built a campaign to win our city council election in 2013, that itself raised the profile of the $15 demand. So in other words, my election was a referendum for 15. Majority of people were already supporting it. That actually put pressure in the mayoral race that same year, actually. And so the guy who won, Ed Murray, another arch corporate Democrat who later left office in a completely discredited fashion, but at that time, he felt pressure to say in name that he supports 15. But what they were really trying to do was co-opt the issue and try to crush the movement. One of the things he did was set up a committee called the Income Inequality Advisory Committee. This was all under pressure from the movement and from my election. But what they were trying to do was to subvert the movement. And so what they did was set up this committee, and he invited me to be on this committee thinking that I would either refuse and isolate myself and my movement, or that I would join and then get co-opted and sell out. Well, we did neither. I said that I will join this committee, but as a representative of working people, and I'm not going to be held to any gag order or non-disclosure agreement with this committee. He was forced to agree. And when he announced that committee at the press conference, I said, I'm joining this committee as a shop steward for working people, just like a union shop steward should fight for their members. That's the approach that allowed people to see and the Democrats to see clearly, we're not going to sell out. Another concrete example is some of the labor leadership who were also forced to support this, but actually were very tied to big business. One day when there was huge, the largest ever support for 15 at the time, one of the most prominent labor leaders came in, in a private labor caucus meeting that I was a part of, said, oh, I've talked to these business leaders. Look, we are doomed. He's saying that we are doomed when we have the highest support in the polls, by the way. Just look at the dishonesty. He said, oh, we're doomed. We can't win 15. We have to settle for 11. And I'm afraid that if we don't settle for 11, we're not going to win anything. You know, there were other people who were weeping in that room. What I did was I said, if this is absolutely shameful for you to peddle this lie, if you try to go ahead with this, tomorrow morning, I will hold a press conference alongside workers and 15 now activists and expose this. If you want it, go ahead. And what happened? He backed down. That's the kind of clear and relentless fighting approach you need in order to fight for working people. And that is the only basis on which we will win.
Well, going back now for a moment to the Workers' Strike Back Conference and Convention last month, you proposed a Fight the Rich campaign. And it made a number of demands. What are those demands? And what is your strategy, more importantly, for winning those demands?
Yes, the demands are all very important. And I would urge people to go to the Workers' Strike Back website, which is workersstrikeback.org, where you can read them in more detail. But very quickly, I can share with you that we agreed on 10 demands, which is fight the rich and the billionaire class and their system. Workers need a real raise, $25 an hour minimum wage, good union jobs for all, stop climate catastrophe, take big energy corporations into workers' ownership, fight racism, sexism, and all oppression, stop mass deportations, Medicare for all and quality affordable housing, tax the rich, end the genocidal war on Gaza, no military aid, no occupation, bring down Trump, the billionaires, and their two parties. Last but not least, no more sellouts. We need a new mass party. And as far as the strategy to win, obviously, we are not going to be able to win all at once, but it is important for us. Then the reason we always, as socialists, we proceed on the first on the basis of laying out a political program, because without having that program as a political compass, it is impossible to guide the movement to fruition, to success. So this is the basis, political basis of our analytical basis, if you will, of what we're doing. And then the strategy then comes down to also very concrete issues. Like I said, we are a growing organization, and it is incredible the degree of support we've had from working people. Every day we get emails from working people saying, I want to join Workers' Strike Back. But tragically for the working class, the big labor leaders, the NGO leaders, the people who could build, who have billions of dollars at their disposal and who could build mass organizations are refusing to do it because they are in alliance with the Democratic Party, and often they are what I would call business unionist leaders, meaning they have this idea of sort of making peace with the bosses and not really bringing the full might of the working class into strike action. Because of all of that, we are starting small. So Workers Strike Back, while it's growing, it's today 900 members, we still have to grow much bigger. And so in the meanwhile, we have to pick battles that we can win, offensive battles, offensive meaning winning victories that we don't have in place right now, like Medicare for All. And so in order to build a nationwide push for Medicare for All, we believe a concrete strategy would be, as I was saying earlier, to put forward a ballot initiative fight in Seattle, where we have the biggest forces for Workers Strike Back. A Workers Strike Back member in Peoria, Illinois, who was telling me that in his city, the city council is now making moves to make the lives of homeless community members even worse than before. They're trying to take away their freedoms, their ability to park on the streets. And so that's an example of a defensive fight that Workers Strike Back should conduct. Go to City Hall, blast the council members in public comment, energize working people around you, and that way we can continue building Workers Strike Back and winning further victories.
How can listeners find your writings, follow your work, get involved in your work if they so are so inclined?
Yes, well, people can definitely go to Workers Strike Back, all one word, workersstrikeback.org. You can find all our event listings. We have monthly meetings every day. And if you're able to join a Workers Strike Back watch party or a chapter meeting, monthly meeting in your city, if you're in Boston or Chicago or Kansas City or Seattle, or you can log into our national Zoom meetings every month. All that information is over there. A lot of our articles and writings are there as well. And for those of your listeners who are not only finding this whole message compelling, but also think that they maybe are ready to join a socialist organization, I would invite them to join Revolutionary Workers, which is my socialist organization, which is part of the leadership of Workers Strike Back.
Uh-huh. Thank you so much. We are so pleased that you were able to join us today here at Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
That myth of cowboy individualism became central to the culture of Republican politics. From 1981 to 2021, Republican policies moved more than $50 trillion from the bottom 90% of Americans to the top 1%. And the party stayed in power through media disinformation, voter suppression, gerrymandering, and the flood of money into politics. Those systemic changes to the political system in the United States moved the Republican Party farther and farther and farther right. And the rhetoric of cowboy individualism, as it did so, became more and more extreme.
That's Heather Cox Richardson, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Heather Cox Richardson on cowboy authoritarianism in America. We are at an inflection point. A chill is sweeping the country. We ignore it at our peril. The warning signs are everywhere. Alaska GOP Senator Lisa Murkowski says, "We are all afraid." Massachusetts Democratic Governor Maura Healey says, "The fear is real." New York Times columnist Masha Gessen writes, "America's police state has arrived." Dissent is being criminalized. People are being deported without due process. Court rulings are being ignored. Democracy, civil liberties, and free speech are all under attack. What can be done to reverse cowboy authoritarianism in America? Our guest today is Heather Cox Richardson. She's professor of history at Boston College. She previously taught at MIT. Her newsletter, Letters from an American, reaches more than 1 million readers. She spoke at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver on April 10th, 2025. The moderator is UBC Professor Heidi Twarick. And now, Heather Cox Richardson.
I wanted to talk today about what's happening in the United States and to address this question of what it means to be an American in 2025. I'm going to argue today that the crisis in today's United States is the logical outcome of 40 years of a Republican ideology that was based in the idea of cowboy individualism. That idea has directed American politics since 1980, at least, when President Ronald Reagan wrote it to the White House. Those people who embrace cowboy individualism believe that a true American is a man who operates on his own, outside the community. He needs nothing from the government. He works hard to support himself. He protects his wife and his children, and he asserts his will by dominating others. That ideology is rooted in the mythological image of the American cowboy who began to drive cattle from the border of Texas and Mexico north across the plains to army posts and railheads in 1866. That image sprang to prominence in the years immediately after the Civil War, and in that peculiar moment, it took on a specific anti-government meaning. A political meaning. The Civil War government in the United States set out to protect Black Americans from persecution by their white neighbors in the American South. In 1868, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution guaranteed equal protection of the laws to formerly enslaved people. And then 2 years later, in 1870, Congress created the Department of Justice to prosecute those people who attacked Black Americans because of their race. So with the federal government suddenly willing to prosecute racial discrimination, former Confederates turned their racial animosity into an economic argument. Beginning in 1871, they claimed that the government's effort to protect civil rights was tantamount to socialism, because the government officials it required to protect Black Americans cost tax dollars. And those tax dollars could only come from hardworking white men in the years after the Civil War. And they were providing that money to provide benefits for undeserving, they said, Black people. Southern Democrats after the war contrasted that government socialism, as they called it, with the image of the American cowboy, who in their view was a young white man who wanted nothing from the government but to be left alone. The cowboy in their view was hardworking, he was good with a gun, and he dominated the women and the racial minorities he encountered in the West. That myth countered the idea that the government should protect all Americans equally. The cowboy image actually faded in the early 20th century progressive era, which is itself an interesting story, but it sprang back to prominence in the 1950s and the 1960s as a propaganda tool to oppose the wildly popular post-World War II government. That government reflected the idea that government had a role to play in regulating business, in providing a basic social safety net, in promoting infrastructure, and in protecting civil rights. And those people who were determined to get rid of government regulation and taxation resurrected the myth of the American cowboy, and they championed this idea of cowboy individualism. They embraced the idea that a government that worked for ordinary Americans was a form of socialism, because it redistributed wealth from hardworking white people to Black Americans, people of color, and women who demanded equal rights. The Republicans nominated Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater, who was famous for his cowboy persona and his white cowboy hat and his opposition to the post-war government. They nominated him for president.
And then, of course, in 1980, Ronald Reagan put aside his British riding clothes, put on a Western cowboy hat, and rode that ideology to the White House. That myth of cowboy individualism became central to the culture of Republican politics as a way for Republican politicians to convince voters to support the destruction of federal government programs that actually benefited them. From 1981 to 2021, Republican policies moved more than $50 trillion from the bottom 90% of Americans to the top 1%. And the party stayed in power through media disinformation, voter suppression, gerrymandering, and the flood of money into politics. Those systemic changes to the political system in the United States moved the Republican Party farther and farther and farther right. And the rhetoric of cowboy individualism, as it did so, became more and more extreme. They demonized non-white Americans and women in the public sphere, and they dismissed all government policies that promoted social cooperation, whether at home or abroad. And in place of the post-World War II idea of cooperation among equals, they replaced that idea with the idea that individual men should dominate society, ordering it as they thought best. Over time, white men rejected the socialization and the education that would enable them to rise to prosperity or to develop meaningful relationships. That domination to which they turned at the heart of cowboy individualism grew increasingly apparent in the United States after 1992, when the modern militia movement took off after a standoff at Ruby Ridge, Idaho, between federal marshals and a former factory worker named Randy Weaver, who had failed to show up to court for a trial on a firearms charge, convinced a number of Western men that they had to arm themselves to fight off the government. By the early 2000s in the U.S., gun ownership first became a symbol of cultural identity, and then it became a way to groom younger people into Republican political ideology. This is why we see political leaders posing with their families holding AR-15s on Christmas cards. The Trump administration has taken cowboy individualism now to an extreme, I believe, gutting the U.S. government and centering power in a dominant president, while also pulling the United States out of the web of international organizations that have stabilized the globe since World War II. The administration began its run in 2025 by firing the women and the racial and gender minorities who held positions in the government. But it is not just exercising domination over others, it is reveling in that dominance and advertising it, especially over the migrants it has sent to prison in El Salvador, showing films of them being transported in chains and displaying caged prisoners behind Homeland Security Kristi Noem, who in those photographs and in that film is wearing a $50,000 gold Rolex watch. In place of cooperation, the Trump administration's determination to exercise its dominance shows, I think, in its plan to invest $1 trillion in the military, after gutting the U.S. Agency for International Development, also known as USAID. Trump has always seen power as a zero-sum game in which for one party to win, others must lose. If, in fact, Trump succeeds in asserting his dominance over the United States of America and over the globe, the Republicans will have succeeded in replacing American democracy with a dictatorship, and they will have rebalanced global power. But you know, with me, there's always a but, right? Those who believe in that ideology of cowboy individualism have not yet established that autocracy that is their end game, in large part because that cowboy ideology is a myth. It has never reflected reality. And right now, MAGA Republicans are watching in real time as their president, Donald Trump, lumps them in with the minorities and people of color they believed were inferior to them. The government programs that Republicans are calling wasteful are not just the ones that supported racial minorities. They are the ones that supported MAGA Republicans. Cowboy individualism was always a myth. It never represented the United States of America. It didn't even represent the cowboys, one-third of whom were black or were men of color, and whose employment actually replicated the low pay and dangerous conditions of Eastern factory workers. In fact, the American West was a multicultural world in which the key to surviving and even prospering was not dominating other people, it was kinship ties and communities. Famous Western trader Kit Carson, for example, often lionized as the real hero of cowboy individualism, spoke English, Spanish, a number of indigenous languages, and was married three times, two times to an indigenous woman, and then to a Mexican woman. When Eastern settlers moved west, they depended on communities to enable them to survive disasters because, for example, every single farm would lose a barn to fire at some point, and you needed to have people for barn raising. That focus on communities in the American West gave the United States of America grassroots political movements, which were named, after all, for the prairie grasses, whose roots can go as deep as 3.5 meters. Those movements included the late 19th century Alliance Movement and the populist movements in the late 19th century that reordered American politics. Central to those movements, those grassroots movements, were the Western women who organized to fund churches and to fund schools and who drove Western politics. For example, when the Western state of Iowa added murals to its state house in 1908 to portray the modern government, the duties of defense, charities, education, and the executive, legislative, and the judiciary, it illustrated those aspects of modern American government, all except defense and legislature, it portrayed them as women. The contrast between the myth of cowboy individualism and the reality of life in the American West matters because they represent two very different versions of the American government. Iowa's depiction of the modern government as support for an inclusive society in which women took full part was part of a larger movement in the early 20th century to change the nature of American government itself. Key to that change was social worker Frances Perkins, which is why you've been hearing so much about her from me lately. As a settlement house worker, she saw firsthand what economists will tell you today, that modern industrialization could not survive without the labor and the participation of the entire community, not just male factory workers, who were actually paid lower than survival wages. Later, when she witnessed the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in 1911, Perkins also saw what happened to communities without government regulation and social services. "I can't begin to tell you how disturbed the people were everywhere," Perkins recalled after the fire. "It was as though we had all done something wrong. It shouldn't have been. We were sorry. We didn't want it that way. We hadn't intended to have 147 girls and boys killed in a factory. It was a terrible thing for the people of the city of New York and the state of New York to face." With her help, the New York Democratic machine remade New York state politics to address the needs of the entire community. When Perkins became Secretary of Labor under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, she took that new government philosophy to the federal level, where she ushered in a dramatic change to the nature of the federal government. With the 1935 Social Security Act, Perkins did more than provide benefits for the elderly and orphans. She created a new kind of United States government. Before Perkins,
The primary function of the federal government was to manage the economic relationships between labor, capital, and resources. Property rights, after all, had been the basis on which North American colonists had found the justification, the legal justification, to rebel against the British Crown. And the focus on the relationships inherent in property ownership had continued to dominate the government that American lawmakers built afterward. But Perkins recognized that the end of government was not to protect property. It was to protect the communities of people who lived in the nation. She recognized that children, the elderly, women, and disabled Americans were as valuable to that community as the young male workers and the wealthy men who employed them. And she molded the government to reflect the idea that the equal value of all Americans meant that they should all have equal protection of the laws and equal access to resources, including social services like health care, education, and child care. Her vision of the U.S. government reflected reality. But Perkins' recognition of community as the heart of the nation directly challenged the power of men who could dominate a world that had been defined by economic relationships. As soon as the Social Security Act passed, opponents worked to destroy it and the new idea of government that it represented. Reaching back to the past, they claimed that such a government would destroy men's willingness to work and ruin the individualism that made America great. In the 1930s, as soon as the New Deal reorganized government around communities, established businessmen set out to resurrect that old form of government, that old economic ideology. And to bolster their support, they welcomed racists who opposed the idea of equal rights for racial and ethnic minorities to their coalition, and that unholy alliance has been well studied. But they also turned to religious traditionalists who had stood against the teaching of evolution in the Scopes trial just a dozen years before the passage of the Social Security Act. Religious traditionalists, especially those in the Southern Baptist Convention, opposed the new system because it recognized equal rights for women. Women's equality, they believed, meant the end of the patriarchy that they thought mirrored God's relationship to his people, and they saw it as an affront to God. Their position that the modern government was un-American then was strengthened in 1962 when the Supreme Court decided the Engle v. Vitale decision, which struck down state-mandated prayer in public schools, and then in 1963 when Abingdon School District v. Shemp prohibited teachers from leading students in prayer or Bible readings. The Supreme Court decisions against prayer in the schools reinforced the idea that the modern government opposed family values. That religious traditionalism took political shape in 1967 when Southern Baptist leaders Paul Pressler and Paige Patterson plotted to take the Southern Baptists back to an older view of the world. They focused on the inerrancy of the Bible, that is, the Bible can't be wrong, but it was really about women's rights, their ideology. They were denying women's equality and pushing them back into a position subordinate to men. By 1972, the issue of abortion would bring this sexist religious backlash into American politics. Abortion had become a centerpiece of the post-World War II government after doctors identified abortion access as a major public health issue in the 1960s. They estimated that there were between 200,000 and 1.2 million illegal U.S. abortions a year, endangering the lives of women, primarily poor women who could not afford a workaround. By 1972, 64% of Americans believed that abortion should be a question answered by a woman and her doctor. 68% of Republicans believed that. But in 1972, before Roe v. Wade, President Richard Nixon was up for re-election, and he and his people were terrified that he would lose the election. So his advisor, Pat Buchanan, urged Nixon to woo Catholic Democrats before the election by turning to the issue of abortion. Although Nixon had virtually the same platform on the issue as Democratic nominee George McGovern, Nixon and Buchanan defined McGovern as the candidate of acid, amnesty for draft dodgers, and abortion. a radical framing designed to attract traditionalists to the Republican Party. As Nixon split the U.S. in two to rally voters, his supporters used abortion to stand in for women's rights in general. Railing against women's equal rights, in her first statement on abortion in 1972, again the year before Roe versus Wade, activist Phyllis Schlafly did not talk about fetuses, but she talked about women's equality. Women's Lib, short for Women's Liberation, is a total assault on the role of the American woman as wife and mother, and on the family as the basic unit of society. Women's Libbers are trying to make wives and mothers unhappy with their career, make them feel that they are second-class citizens and abject slaves. They are promoting federal daycare centers for babies instead of homes. They are promoting abortions instead of families. In 1979, the first deadline for the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment enshrining women's rights in the U.S. Constitution passed with the amendment unratified, and candidate Ronald Reagan welcomed right-wing Southern Baptist leaders like Pat Robertson, Billy Graham, and Jerry Falwell into his coalition. As the power of those evangelicals grew, Republican culture attacked the modern government by relegating women to the roles of wives and mothers or as sex objects. With talk radio hosts like Rush Limbaugh referring to women who wanted equal rights as feminazis who were destroying society, and after 1996, the Fox News Channel portrayed women's ideal submissive role quite carefully as younger women deferred to older white male hosts like Bill O'Reilly and displayed their bodies under low-cut shirts and short skirts that could be seen under the new glass desks that they used on those sets. But this attempt to undermine the modern government was running up against women's changing political voice. American women tended to vote as their husbands did until 1980, when political observers first saw a gender gap in voting. Women turn out in higher numbers to vote than men do, and at higher rates, and they vote for Democratic candidates at higher rates than men do. If you break that statistic down by race, the numbers are even starker, with black women and women of color voting in significantly higher percentages for Democratic candidates than men do. So the attempt to get rid of the modern American state began to take shape as an evangelical emphasis on gender domination in households. Wildly popular books and religious culture emphasized a woman's duty to produce a lot of children and to do as her husband or father told her. In 2014 and 2015, this impulse to remove the equality of women from American society showed in Gamergate, when men complained about their inability to find women who would date them and began to call themselves incels or involuntary celibates and began to refer to women as NPCs, non-player characters, who are there to make the story move forward for the playing characters. By the way, a term that you see Elon Musk using a lot these days. When you see NPCs, that's what he's talking about. In the 2016 campaign, Republican candidate Donald Trump faced off against Hillary Clinton, who had so specifically defended the idea of a community-based government that she wrote a book titled It Takes a Village. Trump demonstrated his dominance over Clinton by physically looming over her at a debate. He called for her to be jailed, and then he boasted of sexual assault. But that boast of sexual assault did not end his candidacy, it strengthened it, as a certain group of Republicans saw attacks on women as attacks on the government that they hated. Once in power, Trump gave the evangelicals what they wanted by stacking the Supreme Court with justices who would overturn abortion rights. In 2025, Trump returned to power by warning voters that the modern American state was literally turning boys into girls, while his vice president, J.D. Vance, urged women to embrace traditional gender roles, including staying in abusive marriages for the sake of the children. In contrast, Democratic candidates, Vice President Kamala Harris and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, emphasized community and the role of government in protecting that community.
You're listening to Heather Cox Richardson on Cowboy Authoritarianism in America. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
Now, Trump's MAGA Republicans control all the branches of the government, but it is not clear that they will be able to suppress the vast majority of Americans who continue to support the government that Francis Perkins ushered in 90 years ago. For one thing, Republican voters are learning that the government they thought was helping women and minorities actually helps them and kept the nation safe. But there's also a key factor at play right now that is coming to a conclusion after the long-standing Republican attacks on women. As they did in Perkins's era, women are still central to the American community, but now there is a twist. Two generations of women striving for education meant that men backed away from professions once women reached parity in those professions.